From jet engines to space rockets, telephones to computers, the world has seen spectacular change in the last 100 years, and the pace of progress is getting faster and faster. From electric cars to the metaverse, drone deliveries to climate solutions and genetic sequencing, we're investing in the companies that are not just changing the world today, but are also shaping the future. The Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Invest in progress. Capital at risk.
Hello and welcome back to The Advice Show. This week we're joined by Scott Gallagher, Director of Leicester-based advice business Rowley Turton. Firstly, congratulations to Scott on winning NMA's Midlands Firm of the Year award. On stage that night, Scott, you said that your biggest development in the last 26 years as a firm has been involving the clients more in financial planning and showing them the tricks of the trade. What can you expand a little bit on that for us?
Yeah, I think like most firms of our kind of age, we were established in 96, we started off with more as financial advisors and financial planning. We kind of always did, but we did it in the background. So we would sit and work out how much we thought somebody needed to save for their retirement, how much protection they might need, etc. We didn't really present that to clients, really, other than kind of maybe on a bit of a paper pad kind of drawing approach. We then started using some cash flow modelling systems. I think Expan had one, sorry, not Expan, Advisor Office we were on at the time. I think they had one and we used some other things. But again, it was still very much used in the background. It wasn't really part and parcel of our service proposition or what we went through with clients. And then I went on a training course, which was, it wasn't actually Paul Armstrong who ran it, as I recall. I think it was another advisor, but it was the Paul Armstrong approach, the bucket and the three hats and all of that stuff for those people that are familiar with that. And he used Truth by Prestwood. And I did that, and thought, well, that was pretty eye-opening. And pretty quickly thereafter, I think I signed up for the Inspiring Advisors information package from Paul Armstrong. And also we signed up for Truth. And both those things I thought were very helpful as a financial advisor / financial planner. And what we then started to do, in particular with clients, is to then go through the financial planning with clients kind of face-to-face as part of the process, almost from the very first meeting, and certainly as a presentation. And what that has kind of led to now is that most of my work with clients is primarily with that, using the Truth financial planning software and taking clients through it. And therefore my client conversations are very much more around where they are and that they're going to be financially secure, which they are going to be in almost all cases. We have very few clients that aren't going to be, our comfortable retirement, should we say. And it's just demonstrating that and looking at the graphs of the inflows and the outflows, but more importantly, the capital charts show they're not going out of money. And what I find is that's much more valuable for the clients because they have a much more reassurance that they're okay. And to some extent, you can kind of, ignore is probably a bit strong, but not be too worried about the economic issues of the day and the markets of the day. So even with Trump's tariffs, and I think at the time we were looking at portfolios that, reviews were done a couple of weeks earlier, were showing, say, 10% return over 12 months. The reviews after the aftermath of the Trump's tariffs were then probably break even, give or take. So we're flatlining, albeit you could argue there's a 10% loss in a couple of months, probably less. However, from all of those reviews, we never had any issues because fundamentally the capital chart for the clients in all cases was showing that they still had more than enough. So whether they'd had a plus 10% year or flat year, or as reviews now are probably 5% up over a year, over 12-month period, they're all fundamentally okay. And that makes life a lot easier for the client. And obviously, and as an advisor, makes it a lot easier for us that you're not getting bogged down in too much in performance questions. Albeit we're quite happy to have those conversations, but we're quite happy with the performance that we do with the clients. But it's, my view is that is less important than the client's overall financial position.
Do you find that it's helped the business grow in terms of clients? And do you find that the clients appreciate those sort of conversations and being involved in?
Yeah, I think indirectly, yes. I think when clients speak to us, we get that financial planning approach across to them. But more importantly, when we start going through it with clients, for I think more advisors are doing this, but when we started, it was maybe 1 in 10 perhaps were doing this kind of approach. I think it's probably a lot more now. But I think it was something that a lot of clients, either people who've never had a financial advisor, obviously haven't shown this, and this is an extra string to our bow, as it were, and a really added value. But also clients that had previous advisors, but were, as we were in the early days, perhaps a bit too financial advice focused, and the planning wasn't really shown to the clients, or perhaps for some firms it wasn't really done too much at all, then I think that's quite eye-opening for them. And it's a whole different experience, I think. So it's not necessarily getting clients in the door, as in people ringing us, because I think it's quite difficult to get that approach across, and perhaps we probably should work on that. But once we do start talking to clients, I think we're more likely to recruit them as clients because of the work that we do and how we demonstrate that. And I think we're much less likely to lose clients because, again, the focus is very much on them and their overall financial position, and isn't quite a dry conversation about markets or products.
Yeah. And related to that, and I suppose related to what I mentioned at the top of the show, that you won our award for the Midlands Firm of the Year, what is it do you think makes Rowley Turton unique, or allows you to be such a great firm in an area that has lots of financial planning businesses?
We somewhat conservatively put it across as being an above average firm for a below average cost, which is a bit daft really from a financial angle from us. But if you look at what we do for clients, then we do financial planning, which not all firms do. We're chartered, which not all firms do. We're award winning, which again, not all firms are. We have a long track record, so we're very well established. And we have as most firms I would hope, we put the client first, but I'm really saying not all firms do put the client first. And so we do look after clients. So we give a very good level of service, typically face-to-face or Zoom reviews, which obviously we should all do. But again, you look at some issues in the profession as a whole, and not every firm has done that as much as they should have done. So we do that, and I say, and all that adds up. But then in terms of our charging structure, we are quite competitive. We generally have a fixed financial planning fee for the work. Our ongoing advice fee, which we typically charge 0.6, is less than the average for the profession. So again, you put those two things together, the service proposition one side, which I would argue is above average, and I think that's downplaying it quite a bit, and our charges, which are below average, then that gap is obviously quite significant. And obviously, we've put a lot of time and effort into our press work in terms of making us marketable. We are not salespeople at all. We're, as a firm, we're very unsalesy, and we would probably be bigger and more successful had we had a slightly more sales-driven ethos, but I'm not sure we'd be as good a firm. So we've spent a lot of time, probably about 15 years ago, so we decided that we wanted to be helping more clients and be a bigger firm. And so we did press work and stuff just to grow our profile fundamentally, and entering the awards is obviously part of that kind of profile.
Yeah, and that helps. By comparison, though, so you have around 450 clients, I believe, but only around 11 employees. Is that correct? And three planners, I think?
Yeah.
Yeah,
those numbers, again, the numbers are debatable in terms of what the right numbers are in terms of clients. You see arguments on whether we've got perhaps too many clients. However, our process has been very much to work efficiently. I think we need to use technology a bit better, and that's part of the practice manager. We'll look at that. But fundamentally, so we have the admin, we have a strong admin and power planning team putting together a lot of the stuff. So our job is obviously to see the clients, ensure that we come up with the ideas and kind of guide the strategy, but it's not necessarily about pulling off a quote or chasing a provider or spending an hour on the phone trying to get a form out of somebody. And so we have took the investment over many years of bringing in support staff, which gives us capacity to take on more clients. And it's always a slight catch-22 or chicken egg thing, which kind of happens first, but we've always taken the profits, employed staff to give us capacity, which then has naturally allowed us to either do more marketing work and press work, or speak to more people and get more clients in and give a better service proposition. And my view on that is, and this isn't to put down one-man bands at all, because there's some great individual financial advisors, but my view is that we're the perfect size. We're not too big, so we're not a big kind of national firm where, I know, like the banks, where you might get the advisor changed every year or so, and so you can't build any relationship, and obviously clients don't like that, and you're just a number. But then equally, we are not just a one-man band. So therefore, if I go on holiday, there is a team of people behind me. So there's the admin power planning and there's the other advisors. So if somebody needs advice, there's one of the other two advisors in the office. And because we're all part of the same group, the knowledge about clients is pretty shared. So they pretty much know my clients, I know their clients, and there's some overlap anyway. And again, if there's a report that needs writing, then that can be done whilst I'm seeing somebody else. So I saw somebody the other day, they're going on holiday this weekend. They need some report about doing some changes. So I said, right, well, I know what we're going to do. I'll get the team prepping that. I've got two or three meetings on this call at the moment. So I'm not doing that myself, but it's not happening. And there's an argument, I know with some advisors, they don't want the additional staff and the headaches it has, and I understand that. That's definitely, it is a problem running a business, trying to keep everyone
costs
happy.
Costs and whatever else.
Yeah. Costs as well. And the other side is about the affordability of it. But I think generally my view is it's kind of made us a bigger, better firm, and the clients see the benefit of that. And to some extent, myself and Alan, my co-director, see the benefits of that, in the sense that things are happening in terms of looking after clients when we're not there, which allows us more freedom in terms of what we're doing, which is good.
Yeah. You were obviously taken on by Alan Tutton. How do you think the business looks now compared to how he viewed it when he founded it in 1996? Do you think it aligns with his vision, or do you think it's the industry and the world has changed to such that it means that it couldn't be the same?
That's a good question. I think broadly aligns. I think to some extent it's better in terms of the planning that we run through with clients. I think that is better, and clients see the value we add. So I think that's better. I think technology has changed massively. I remember getting the first computer, and I think I had something like 250 meg of memory, and we were like, oh, well, that will see us out for like ever. And then within a couple of years, it was effectively redundant. The internet coming on. And I started it. Firm was joined in 96, and I joined in 97. Regrets would be that we didn't really see the internet for what it would become. So you look at people like Hargreaves Lansdown and other people that have really taken advantage of that and phenomenal success. And yes, if I had a crystal ball or a TARDIS time machine and could go back in time, things you would change is, yes, I would have embraced the internet much more. To be honest, I'm very happy where we are. I probably would have started doing things earlier. If knowing what I know now, we would have probably got involved with Paul Armson and that whole thing as soon as we could have done, not stumbled across it later. We would have done the cash flow planning with clients sooner and in front of them, almost from day one, I would argue. And the internet and the press work and the marketing and everything else that's grown us, because we were a small firm, very good. And we would sit in the office and go, well, why aren't people calling us? Because we were very good advisors. We were not marketeers or salespeople. So again, part of my thing is, yes, if we'd started doing the things that we do very well 10 or 20 years earlier in terms of growing the business would be four or five times the size today.
Maybe you'd be on a beach now. Scott,
yeah, well, whilst I love my clients, I love a job. If somebody walked in with a check for X millions, like anybody, I would probably be inclined to take it. But we are still some way off that. So I'm still planning on advising clients for the next 5 to 10 years plus.
In your entry earlier in the year to the NMA Awards, you wrote, yes, we actively support the development of our staff and have taken specific initiatives to recruit and nurture future technical staff, analysts and advisors. Could you just expand a little bit on that? For me, Scott.
Yeah, entirely. So I am, I suppose, the ultimate product of that. I answered a somewhat, it was an advert for a trainee IFA in a local paper, which was Leicester Mercury, when we had local papers and we had adverts for pre-internet days. And so I'm showing my age a little bit. I didn't even know what a trainee IFA was, but I was unhappy at the Alliance of Leicester, and I was basically applying for any job I could get. And I thought, okay, I could probably do that job. I'm sure I've met the qualifications, I'll be fine. Met Alan, the managing director. And it was literally Alan in the basement of an accountancy firm. Didn't tell my parents that. They left the Alliance Leicester, quite a big, respectable building society, to work with one guy in a basement. I emphasised the size of the accountancy practice, Rowley's, that we were associated to. And that was my focus. I didn't tell them it was a one-man business. They'd been running for a year in a basement. I skipped that element of it. And the trainee IFA title was probably a bit optimistic, but I went in knowing very little about financial services, bit of bank background, but that was just in the accounts department. And essentially learned everything, admin, power planning, and eventually became advising. And primarily became advisor, also I don't think I'm the world's best people skills person, and I've worked on that a lot, technically, also been very happy with that. But working with people, you come across different levels of technical knowledge. Alan's very good, but I've known other people who are not as solid. And you think, well, hang on, I know more than they did. So I thought, well, I'll push myself to become a financial advisor at some point. So I've done that. We've got a girl, Gemma, who came in as administrator, is now power planning, other people that promote. We've always taken the view to push people who work for us to, you know, let them do more and more, encourage them, depending on which way you look at it. Quite keen on delegating. And when you break down the jobs, you realise that, you know, as much as we make this overly complicated, some elements aren't. I remember talking to one of the girls who was an administrator, and then we pushed her into power planning. And I was like, well, hang on a second, you can enter a Finometric questionnaire and you can analyse the results of that. You can use an FE scan to analyse a portfolio and you understand how that works with risk and reward and stuff like that. You can obtain quotes, you can write a report. And then you start to put it together, and, well, that's pretty much power planning, pretty much, you know, with a little bit of gap filling. And therefore, you can take people from administration to power planning at the moment. And that's what we've done with people, and we're quite keen on that. We pay for every staff member's CII membership, quite happy to support them in terms of studying towards exams and supporting on that. I've just recruited my lad, which is slightly questionable in terms of it's my lad, but he's just finished an economics degree at Leicester, and he's joined us as a apprentice power planner. I think he will get a first, at least a 2-1 from Leicester. He's very bright. He's coming in knowing very little about financial services, albeit he's helped us out a bit in the past. He came in and did a day a week a few months ago when we were particularly busy and helped out. And he kind of was thrown in at a deep end. He's done quite well. So we're hoping that he is, I don't know, the next line in development of Ready Certain, perhaps, because I'm 51, so I'm not planning on being an advisor or working when I'm in my 70s. I'm not desperate to retire.
Yeah.
But we are conscious of that succession planning. Alan's a bit older than me. So we are trying to look at that, building that, newer, younger team. And that's probably the project for the next 5-10 years, I suspect, because we don't want to see what we've built up and the work that we do for clients effectively just sold on and just disappear.
Your succession plan really interested me in your entrance, actually. You asked which one of the following best describes your succession plan, and you responded sell to another advice business. I suppose the other option is a management buyout. What are the pros and cons of that? And I suppose, when do you think Alan and yourselves might look to exit?
Yeah, that was interesting. That might have been jigs in sense. I think sell to another firm, we've had conversations when we're always very honest with clients about this and the staff, to be honest, as well, because I think it's a bit daft. You look at the ages of Alan, who's in his mid-60s, and myself, who's just into my 50s, then you have to logically think, well, okay, what is the plan? And I think we're covering both bases. If we were to sell, and we spoke to some people about this, some people in the industry, and we are at, I think, what's termed, I don't know, an awkward size is probably what I would describe as because where we are, we're not on the market for a lot of firms because we're too big. And I think their view is that we would become a regional hub, I think is the idea, that some firm who wanted a Leicester-based presence but didn't really have it would buy us and then put us into some part of a larger group, which would actually have benefits potentially for clients in terms of being part of a bigger organization, albeit with my caveats about being a number rather than a name. It would have lots of benefits for the staff in terms of opportunity to grow as part of a bigger company, and obviously it would preserve what we did whilst, you know, fitting quite nicely. Other sale options really aren't particularly applicable. But given my lads just joined us, then we've definitely got another option on the table, which is that we look in a different direction and we continue to grow the business. I'm not desperate to leave, certainly not fully. And then Alan equally isn't really desperate to leave. And then basically keep the business for the next generation. Because the other side of it, the sale price for IFA businesses seems to have softened a bit recently, with various reasons of, you know, interest rates, etc. and introduce regulatory issues around some firms. And therefore, it doesn't necessarily seem a great deal for the business owners to sell it on the cheap, as it were, versus owning it. I think the risk is some people need to sell the business because it's their retirement. Me and Alan are very much trying to structure the business and our own personal finances following the sensible financial planning and Paul Armisen approach of financial independence. So ensure that we have sufficient wealth outside the business, pensions, investments, ISAs, etc., that we're not entirely reliant on the business for our own financial success. And therefore, that means that hopefully we won't have quite the same compulsion to sell as perhaps some other financial advisors might have.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, there's been a lot of discussion about consolidation. I suppose that's been the big hot topic in the last 18 months in the market. Do you or Alan have a strong view on consolidators? Would that be something that you wouldn't explore?
We would. Having looked after clients for almost 30 years, the last thing we're looking to do is to take a quick win or a quick book and then throw them to the wolves. And the problem is that some of the models from some of the consolidators are not great. We had clients, the bright side of consolidators is it tends to be a shakeout of clients, and we tend to pick up a few every time a local firm goes down that road. I remember taking on a client, and they'd been taken over by a consolidator, or the advisor had more accurately, and the consolidator was looking at charging them 3% initial fee, and we're like, hang on a second, you're already with them, so why are you paying a new 3% fee? And the ongoing advice fee, I think, was going to 1%. And I looked at it and I thought, well, hang on a second. Literally, logically, the IFA that sold the business is literally giving it away, because what are they going to get paid? You know, 2-4% at most. Well, if the new consolidator is charging all the clients 3% across the board, well, that's all the sale proceeds gone. And our view is, well, if we wanted to, in my view, rip off clients by charging them 3% for effectively saying with the same organisation, albeit slight change at the top, then, you know, well, why wouldn't we just charge our clients 3% and keep the company? It makes no sense to sell our company and then the clients effectively pay for that sale. That's completely daft. So we would be very cautious about who we sold to, because the problem that we have is that not only from a professional angle, but also a personal angle, these clients are in many cases friends. You know, so I was at the golf club the other day. I'm trying to work on my handicap. It's shocking. We've glossed over that very quickly. And I bumped into a client that's just coming on board, and we had a 10, 15 minute chat about the paperwork I'd sent him and what he needed to send back, etc. Yeah, and a lot of our clients are through that kind of field and in other fields that I know. And then I have clients that I see at the football and stuff like that. And I'm thinking, well, hang on, if we sold out to somebody who we felt was not doing a good job for the client in whatever ways.
Yeah, and then you see them later.
Yeah, I see them the next week or 6 months or a year later. I'm going to be getting daggers, aren't I? And that's, you know, that's...
They're your mates.
What's the point? Okay, we might bank a few more quid at outset, but again, it's never been a sole driver for me and Alan. I don't want to be a poor financial advisor. I tell clients I want happy, wealthy clients, because in simple terms, I'll be a happier, wealthier financial advisor. I don't want to be poor and happy clients, because I don't want to be a poor and happy financial advisor. But the driver's never been about being stupidly rich. It's about doing a good job for clients. And Alan also says, you do a good job for clients and the money follows. And that generally is our approach. And that's possibly part of the reason that we're still here almost 30 years from outset, and some of the firms have come and gone because some people have taken a very shortcut approach, have overcharged clients, have done things that they shouldn't have done, and people get away with it for a while, but it doesn't last forever.
In favour of that short sugar rush.
Yeah.
The bottom line that they see on a page. Presumably you guys have been approached by some of those businesses.
Yeah, we got approached by True Potential a little while ago in the 8% days, which was, and to be honest, that was never really going to happen, because when you crunch the numbers, the 8% was on a small part of your bank. It would get chiseled away for older clients and some of the cases. So you're never going to get 8%. The structure of it was very tax inefficient and left you all the liability. So when you crunch it, still was probably a reasonable, attractive deal, but it was... You net were not getting 8% in your pocket. It's fair to say you were going to get a lot less than that. It was still probably a good deal. But again, the question is, well, how are they going to pay for that 8%? And fundamentally, it was from them really not being independent, because essentially it's this vertical stacking, isn't it, where they get several bites of the cherry, and their proposition would have, by definition, had to be more expensive than ours in order to recover that 8% within a reasonable length of time. And so we were not going to turn down a conversation about 8% of the client book, because that would have been madness. But it was one meeting, and it was, we come back to the office and went, oh yeah, if they were writing a check for 8% with no strings and buying the entire company, that's an insane price. We would have been foolish not to consider it. But that wasn't the reality of what the deal would have been.
Probably a sensible decision in the aftermath as well.
I've read cases where people were claiming it was direct offer, but then they were sat with the clients in the IFA's office talking them through the online or the paperwork or whatever, and then people got in trouble for that. So again, foreseeable. Well, I'd say with the benefit of hindsight, probably was foreseeable. So.
And Scott, sort of just coming to the end now, but can I just ask, sort of over the last few years, there's obviously been quite a lot of regulatory change, Consumer Duty perhaps being the headline one of that. How did that sort of change your business, if at all? Was there any sort of realignment needed around that?
It's interesting, regulatory change, because every one that is floated is always the end of financial advice or financial advisors, and it rarely is. So ones that I remember is, and I forget the order, which is annoying, but treating customers fairly was supposed to solve all these problems and seems to have been ignored in my view of the wider industry. I was a story the other day about platform delays and how long it takes to move money from platform A to platform B. Well, that's, in my view, is a breach of treating customers fairly, outcome 6, post-sale barriers to exit. Doesn't seem to ever achieve anything. And we obviously went through RDR, which was the end of financial advisors. And to be honest, all you had to do was be upfront about your charges, which we were always anyway. We didn't lose any, well, that's not fair. We didn't lose any clients that we wanted to retain. We offered to act for, but didn't follow up on some smaller clients, which we were not really, it wasn't really cost effective to do the annual reviews. So we let some smaller clients drift off. But all the core clients stayed. We didn't lose a single client. Consumer Duty, again, we went through all of that. We've done the value assessments, etc. And again, it goes back to my earlier point about an above average firm for below average costs. So for us, that was really, really good. I think the concern with the Consumer Duty and all regulation really is there's a lot of cost, time and other for firms to comply. But fundamentally, does the industry really get any better? There's still scandals go on. I'm always a bit sceptical on the cost-benefit analysis. And you look at SJP, which came out and said, oh, no, we have to change our charging structure because of Consumer Duty. And then they've gone, oh, yeah, oh, by the way, we're going to delay that change. So, well, what is it? If Consumer Duty means that their current charging structure is not appropriate, A, how was that not fixed as soon as Consumer Duty came in and preferably before it was live? But how are they able to, you know, delay it? You know, well, are they the largest financial advisor firm in the UK? Something like 10% of advisors.
Yeah.
And the FCA seems to go, yeah, you just take your time, lads. We're not too fussed.
Perhaps a good place to end. Good question to end on. Yeah. Scott, thank you so much. Thanks for joining us.
No, thanks for having me on, Julian.
From jet engines to space rockets, telephones to computers, the world has seen spectacular change in the last 100 years, and the pace of progress is getting faster and faster. From electric cars to the metaverse, drone deliveries to climate solutions and genetic sequencing, we're investing in the companies that are not just changing the world today, but are also shaping the future. The Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Invest in progress. Capital at risk.